906.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Justice and vengeance are often seen as two sides of the same coin, with justice viewed as the rational, dispassionate cousin to the more uncivilized, violent instincts of vengeance. But in the face of some hideous headlines lately and Americans' angry gut reactions to them, it's hard to sort out what we really mean by justice or vengeance. For example, the controversy over where to bury the body of one of the Boston bombers. How do we balance the biblical eye for an eye versus forgive your enemies? And if Newtown killer Adam Lanza had survived, could justice really be served in the case of such a horrendous crime? And whose justice are we talking about? For the victims, for society, or for the rule of law? The Socrates Exchange returns as we examine the question of how do we weigh justice with vengeance? Exchange listeners, what do you think? Let's hear from you. Are justice and vengeance different, or are they really the same thing? Is one necessarily better than the other, or does it depend on the circumstances? Is the desire for vengeance innate, part of our DNA? And how do we weigh these ideas in cases where the perpetrators themselves might have also been victims? Get Socratic on us, Exchange listeners. Join our conversation on the Socrates Exchange. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. And our philosopher for the hour is Nick Smith. He's an associate professor of philosophy at UNH. His forthcoming book is The Penitent and the Penitentiary. His other book is I Was Wrong, The Meanings of Apologies. And Nick Smith, it is great to see you. Welcome back.
Hi, Laura.
Well, what are some of the big questions, Nick, we keep coming back to when people talk about how do we weigh justice with vengeance?
Well, this show today is probably going to get us into some of the dark and ancient aspects of the human mind. when we start to see how central themes of revenge and vengeance are within our culture, whether it's in our comic book characters, there's this sort of repetitive theme of getting revenge, to our justifications for going to war, to even a show like Game of Thrones that so many people have been talking about in the last few months. The notion of revenge is really a central trope for us. And we can start to see a few different kinds of questions that will probably come up today. One is just getting at basically what we mean by revenge. Are we talking about an emotion, a belief? Is it sort of the actual act of hurting someone, injuring someone, causing someone to suffer? How does something like revenge compare to retribution or very different kinds of justifications for punishing someone, such as deterrence, incapacitation, or rehabilitation? And then there are the questions of whether we should be feeling, right, angered, hurt, vengeful. Just imagine if you or one of your children were injured by the Marathon bombers, and imagine you didn't feel a thirst for revenge. Would that mean there's something wrong for you? I mean, is there a sort of sense that you should want the offender to suffer, right? That there's this kind of what we call the normativity of emotions, that you should be feeling anger and revenge. And if you don't, there's something too passive or almost wimpy about you. And then there's a different question of whether feeling those emotions is one thing, acting on them is something different, right? Whether if we feel that we want revenge, we have a thirst for revenge, should we act out on that? And if we think we should act out on it, is it better for a neutral third party like the state to execute our revenge? Or
that's
should we be more like sort
in.
Of vigilante about questions of revenge and pursuing them ourselves?
Yeah, and you asked, what do we really mean by vengeance? And then what do we really mean by justice? I mean, whose justice are we talking about?
Yes, the notion of revenge, when I contrast it to something like retribution, as you said before, it's we often think of retribution as being a kind of, an eye for an eye, a cold, cool, mathematical calculation of someone has done something wrong and they deserve this. Vengeance, on the other hand, seems more like sort of wild, emotional. You want the person to suffer as much as you can, and the more you can make them suffer sometimes, it seems like that's the Hollywood narrative. The more you can make them suffer, the better sort of job you've done.
That's interesting. You use the word wild. Francis Bacon, I've got a quote here, says, revenge is kind of a wild justice. So there's that word. Lots to explore this hour, and we'd love to hear from you. The Socrates Exchange returns today on The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Just a quick reminder to you that the Socrates Exchange is different from our regular program. Nick Smith is not he's a philosopher. He's not a judge. He's not a prosecutor, although he used to be a lawyer. So Nick's role is not to answer this question of justice and vengeance and how we weigh them, but instead to ask you more questions. So join us, 1-800-892-6477. And Nick, we already have a caller on the line, and this is Renee in Dover. Hi, Renee. Welcome to the Socrates Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning. I would like to pose that I believe justice is really rationalized compensation.
And could you explain there? So is the idea there that so someone takes something from you by injuring you and justice is the process of compensating them? Is that what you're getting at there?
So, yes, because I don't think justice as, you know, meant by the definition really exists.
Good.
That the way that justice is applied, it's a rationalized compensation.
Can you now imagine something like the case of the marathon bombers?
Sure.
And now when we imagine what they've taken from us,
yeah,
how do we compensate something like that?
Well, there really is no way to truly compensate, but I believe that, you know, the people that would suggest, you know, the death penalty or something to that effect, that, you know, they're trying to apply sort of the eye for an eye sort of, you know, compensation, like you hurt me, I hurt you. There's no way to apply justice. There's only a way to sort of try to balance the scale.
How about since there's presumably only two offenders and lots of victims and lots of deaths, some people say that the way to balance the scales then is to make the offender suffer as much as possible, for example, by torturing them, or to try to squeeze as much suffering as we can. Would you go for that as a way to try to balance the scales and to put more pain on the other side of the ledger?
No, I'm not suggesting that. I don't think that there is anything that you can do to set the scale right in this sort of situation. I don't believe there is any justice that could come from this particular example.
Good.
Great to hear from you, Renee. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
All right. And again, the number for you to join us on the Socrates Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You know, Renee's question raised another question in my mind, Nick. You know, is there such a thing as perfect justice, or are we always just doing our best? So that's what her thoughts raise in me. Thank you so much, Renee. Let's take Lisa, perhaps, in Center Harbor. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Hi, Lisa. You're on the Socrates Exchange with Nick Smith. Go ahead.
Hi. I really just feel that vengeance is a very dangerous area. I think it just creates an avenue for people to continue to do wrong and act on a very, very heightened emotion, a very strong emotion that we do innately feel. I completely agree that, you know, if someone were to harm one of my children, those feelings would be there whether I wanted them to be there or not. But to act on them now makes me doing wrong as well. And two wrongs do not make a right. And now I have to deal with those feelings. Now I have to deal with, one, my children are harmed, and now I've done something that could cause further harm. It could cause further damage to my family. It doesn't bring anything back. It doesn't do anything. And murder is murder. You know, if someone kills my child and I kill the murderer, it's still murder. It's still a wrong act. It doesn't make it right.
So do you think it's appropriate to feel revenge? So if someone injured your children, are you saying, it sounds like you're suggesting that feeling it is okay, and yeah, perhaps even you should feel want revenge?
I have a hard time with the word revenge. I think that we're going to feel those things anyways. There's always a desire, you know, if someone harms my children, I want them to understand how I feel. I think the point of revenge is we want them to know how badly they've harmed us. We want them to hurt too. So we need to be very careful with that. We need to maybe express how we're feeling, you know, have people understand the hurt they've caused us. But to want to harm someone back, that's not part of my personality. That's not who I want to be. I don't want to turn into a Jekyll and Hyde person because I've been wronged. And believe me, I would have to fight that if someone harmed my child. But I don't think that that's okay. I don't think that we should allow ourselves to go to that place.
So you generally don't think that we should want to harm offenders. So you're, if someone hurt your children, your ideal response would be to sort of just talking them through that and explaining why what they did was wrong, and you don't think that they deserve
to
suffer?
I would want justice to happen. I would want the full extent of the law, but I would not want to take it into my hands. I don't want to allow, because I'm too close. It's too personal. It's too close. It would not be appropriate, and I would not be able to be rational in my thinking.
Good.
About
so
it.
Is it that you want the state to make the offender suffer? So you want the offender to suffer, but you want the state to do it, and you want to keep your hands clean?
I don't want suffering. I want appropriate punishment. I want appropriate discipline. You know, you don't get to walk around and harm people and create wrong without having to have the consequences for it. But there's a difference. There's a very fine line, and there is a difference between wanting someone to suffer and wanting someone to have their consequences. I don't want anyone to suffer. I don't believe in that. I don't like that. I think that's a bizarre place in a human's mind to want someone to suffer. But I do want people to have their consequences from their behavior.
And
absolutely.
And by consequences, you mean something simply like incapacitation to keep them from reoffending? So if we could incapacitate them without making them suffer, so put them in a really nice, you know, dorm room with lots
no,
of...
No, not at all. No
so,
way.
So you think they need to suffer. So they need to suffer in some respect.
They don't need to suffer, but they don't need to have a really nice dorm room with a TV. No way.
Lisa, it's great to hear from you. Thanks Thank so you. Much for getting Socratic with us today. We appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Again, the number for you to join us on the Socrates Exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Nick, we'll go into the break with this email from Sean in Manchester. He says, justice is balance. It's supposed to make you whole again. Vengeance, on the other hand, is a plate best served cold. Sean, thanks for that one. We'll take more of your calls after a short break. 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Want to join the exchange team? Well, the Barber and Dick Couch Fellowship is your opportunity. NHPR is looking for a recent college graduate, savvy with social media and eager for a hands-on experience with New Hampshire's signature statewide talk show. Apply today at nhpr.org. Abundant sunshine today. High temperatures around 65 north of the mountains, closer to 70 in central New Hampshire, 70 to 75 in parts of southern New Hampshire. NHPR Daily Weather Report made possible with support from Public Service of New Hampshire. Support also comes from the Art of the Americas Wing at the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston, where America's treasures bring history to life. More at MFA.org. From Exeter Hospital, helping you know how to perform life-saving CPR by sponsoring a public CPR training class Saturday, June 8th at 9 a.m. Registration 580-6668. And New Hampshire Catholic Charities providing job training, parenting education, counseling, and more. Information about Catholic Charities and annual appeal at nh-cc.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the Socrates Exchange returns as we examine the question of how do we weigh justice with vengeance. Exchange listeners, what do you think? Are justice and vengeance different, or are they the same thing? Is one necessarily better than the other, or does it depend on the circumstances? And how do we weigh these ideas of justice with vengeance, especially in cases perhaps where the perpetrators themselves might have also been victims? Get Socratic on us, the number 1-800-892-6477. Our philosopher for the hour is Nick Smith, Associate Professor of Philosophy at UNH. And Nick, let's go right back to our listeners. And Ken's calling from Walpole. Hi, Ken. You're on the Socrates Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Nice to talk with you.
I'm guessing this is Ken Burns.
It is. Hi.
Hi.
Good to be with you again. I love the show. I think the difference between retribution and justice is the difference between a kind of tribal configuration and a civilized one. It may be in the human breath that we feel the emotions for revenge, for retribution, but is the civilized imposition, the governor on those emotions, that makes us truly civilized, as your last caller, I think, very articulately did. We just finished a film on the Central Park jogger case where the prosecutors there to serve the victims and society actually created more victims, and it was very outrageous. And there is a movement afoot to have one of those prosecutors, who is an adjunct professor at Columbia, fired, and the other, who has retired and is a celebrated crime novelist, to have her publisher discontinue publishing, both of which I think are examples of retribution, and both of those actions, I think, miss the point of continuing with a great deal of forbearance and patience, not to mention a lot of outrage, to try to still seek justice for the Central Park Five within the confines of our system and not go outside of it, however satisfying, emotionally satisfying it might be.
Can I see that you're inclined to imagine justice being a sort of cool, calm, state-administered process, but is it the state's job to administer suffering? I mean, is part of justice making the offenders feel pain? So again, if we go back to the marathon bombers, I mean, if we could just, you know, incapacitate them, and if we could do it in a way that minimized...
Well, I think the suffering, your suffering angle, which you also pursued with the last caller, is one that I think it's rooted too much in that Old Testament kind of tribal eye for an eye thing. I think justice itself is a civilized solution to understanding that the human breast is going to react with violence, particularly if it was my child in the case of the marathon bombing or some other instance, the famous Dukakis thing.
Yes,
what would
good.
You do if your daughter was raped by the rapist that had done this? And he tried to have a civilized response when all we wanted to see was his humanness. Yeah, I'd tear him from limb to limb, but thank God we have a system that allows this to be meted out in a much more civilized way. So I think suffering becomes too much slanted towards retribution. Obviously, punishment is an important thing for crime, and part of it isn't a luxury dorm room, as you suggest, but in fact, something fairer than that. But beyond that, it is not the business of individuals to seek, I believe, the suffering of the other. It is, in fact, what civilization does to mitigate this age-old human instinct for revenge.
Good,
I mean, look, we like the Sopranos for a very simple reason, which is they get to kill the people that piss them off.
Good. I love the Dukakis example, especially, and I find it powerful, and I find that, you know, many leftists really think that revenge is a dirty word. What do you make of those who think that, you know, those on the left are kind of being wimpy pushovers when we fail to, you know, to exact retributive justice? How do you respond to those kinds of wimpy pushover claims that we don't have the spine to exact justice?
Well, we've invented something called the law, and we've been evolving this over time in our pursuit of happiness, capital H, which is not a pursuit of objects in a marketplace of things, but a pursuit of lifelong learning. So human beings are permitted, particularly in civilized circumstances, to evolve the idea of justice, of law. And I think this is not at all wimpy. This is civilization. Now, this is not to say that when the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor or that Al-Qaeda attacks the World Trade Center, that we don't respond appropriately. That no one does that. But I think you have to distinguish between what we do collectively to the crimes that are committed against us individually and what we wish individually in our own hearts to do.
Oh, dear. I think Ken's phone finally went out on us, and that's too bad because I had something I wanted to get his thoughts on, too. Ken, thanks a lot for joining us on the Socrates Exchange. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Again, it's the Socrates Exchange today, and we're looking at the question of how do we weigh justice with vengeance? Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Nick is calling from Milford. Hi, Nick. You're on the Socrates Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me on the show again.
Sure.
I've been hearing a lot about this morality, you know, an eye for an eye, it's wrong, you know, to commit a murder for someone who murdered somebody in your family or whatever, it's morally wrong. But at the same time, if you don't do anything about something, like if you have no way to avenge it, then it sort of sets a precedent that, you know, it's okay for someone to do that to you. Like if you rob a store and they don't call the police, they don't try to apprehend you, they just let you walk out the front door with something that you've taken, you know, who's to say you're not going to go back 2 days later and rob that same store again because, you know, they're not going to do anything about it.
So there's a societal goal here.
Good. Yeah. Now we can distinguish here between the difference between, you know, vengeance, wanting the offender to suffer, and some kind of form of law, as law and justice is just social control, right? That we are, you know, we're kind of animals and we need to be, you know, behavioristically, you know, induced not to steal things, and that we can do that without necessarily wanting revenge. But we could also probably do that without, right, making the offender suffer too much, right? I mean,
right.
We could maybe prevent people from stealing or killing people by, you know, rehabilitating them, getting them nice therapy, getting them a good education, giving them sort of the best, right, the best that money can buy in order to make their lives better, all of which could feel, right, quite good and not have any suffering involved, right? And part of the deal with vengeance is that it seems like the suffering is an important part of it. That's why I'm pushing on that. I mean, do you think criminals need or deserve to suffer? Or if we can solve the problem of crime by other means, is that okay?
Well, I think that like the power of shame, actually, like people sort of underestimate that ability for someone to feel shame. And like, I mean, back in, you know, colonial times, they have public executions and public, you know, they put people in the stockades, and it sets that example for the whole town to see, like, you know, this person did something wrong. This is them on trial now. And, you know, people could, you know, walk by, they threw tomatoes at them, and, you know, like for someone to be up there and they can't get out of it, they're locked in a stockade. So for someone to be up there and everybody they know, everybody that they deal with every single day in their community is walking by, and they look at you with just this disgust, like you're in there for a reason.
So maybe humiliation is also a form of a vengeance. So maybe instead of, you know, executing or whipping offenders, we should just, you know, publicly humiliate them. Is humiliation an appropriate goal for justice?
Humiliation could be, but I mean, in certain cases, you may need to have, because there are some people who just, they don't have that capacity to feel shame, and there may need to be more drastic action. But I remember when I was a kid, they executed Timothy McVeigh on TV, but that's only on TV. So, you know, the whole nation was able to watch it, but TV is very desensitizing. You know, you can see all kinds of gore and violence and sex and drugs and all that on TV, and it doesn't really affect people as much as them seeing it firsthand.
I want to ask you a question too, Nick. Yeah, and thank you so much for calling. I want to ask you a question too, if I could.
Sure.
I'm interested in this, you know, sort of old-fashioned stockade shame and so forth. For some people, justice is more personal. So let's say you harmed me. How do I personally benefit from you being publicly shamed? You know, why should Nick Smith, who wasn't victimized, also have the opportunity to hurt you or shame you? Maybe it should just be between you and me.
It kind of brings that community together, and it reestablishes that sense of communal right and wrong. When the whole community can participate in this shaming, they're, you know, say that I'm in the stocks and you're throwing vegetables and stuff at me. If you get all your neighbors in on it, then it kind of brings the community together, and it reestablishes that what I would have done was wrong, and that it should be punished, and that, I mean, it shows a lot more people that punishment, I think.
Do you worry that people might enjoy the process of punishing others too much? It was once, you know, it's kind of sadistic, right? It's called the pleasure of the fury, right? Where, you know, they sort of think of the Colosseum. Right? You bring those who've, you know, thought to be engaged in illegal activities, and you engage in the frenzy of watching them get torn apart and tortured. And that revenge isn't just a kind of bloodlust, right? The whole idea of the stockade and you know, public torture and humiliation. It's really more like spectacle and entertainment and just sadism.
You know, Nick, thank you so much for calling. And the other thing that he's made me think about, so thank you, Nick, very much, is justice a community response? It isn't just about me versus the person who hurt me. It's he's giving us a sense that it's a community issue. I think that's really interesting. Let's take another call. And as I understand, Ken Burns is back with us. We lost him on the phone. Ken, thanks for being back with us. You were about to make one more point and you got cut off. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know, remember quite that what. It's just the revenge of this beautiful state of ours is that every once in a while we pass through a no-cell zone because of the mountains. And that's a different kind of retribution, I suppose. I think, you know, enshrined in our Bill of Rights is the notion of we don't do cruel and unusual punishment. And I just believe part of human evolution is not taking punishment away. It's just making it not cruel and unusual. And part of making it not that is to depersonalize it so that in speaking about Dukakis or in speaking about someone personally hurt by or someone they knew hurt by the marathon bombing or 9/11 or some such thing, that we have an appropriate collective response and we don't meet it out in a vigilante style, which is what the present-day manifestation of that old eye for an eye gives it.
When you keep using that word justice as if it's something different from retribution, I mean, do you have a sense that justice is something more like forgiveness or...
No, not at all. Not at all. I think justice is a very, very, very complicated thing and, of course, has to do with the nature of the crime. I mean, if it's stealing a cookie from the cookie jar, is justice merely the acknowledgement of one's crime and the forgiveness by the parent of that? Obviously, as we move up to murder and mass murder and terrorism, we have different senses of what justice is. But what we've done is designed a system, an overlay of human response, which naturally wants to seek retribution and revenge, and we have evolved this over time, which we call justice or we call a manifestation of civilization.
Well, Ken, glad we got you back. Thank you very
much.
Yeah,
I'm glad. Thank you. This is so interesting. What a great conversation.
All right. And you can join the Socrates Exchange today on this question of how do we weigh justice with vengeance, 1-800-892-6477. And as you're hearing when you call in, stay on the line, get Socratic with Nick Smith, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Aaron's waiting in Alton Bay, Nick. Hi, Aaron. You're on the Socrates Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to bring up the ideal here, and you guys have kind of touched on it, especially for the last couple of calls. This ideal of justice as a nation versus justice as a community. And I think the dynamics of what any group of people end up feeling is justice versus retribution changes quite significantly once you start looking at it on such a national and even global stage for that matter. And other callers had mentioned kind of the historical versions of what we did based on how we felt of that justice or retribution needed. And I just wanted to bring up that it's changed quite significantly, and there was other, you know, kind of not prehistoric, but, you know, earlier cultures, like even the Iroquois of the 17th century, they were focused more on who was offended versus the offender. So the person that, you know, experienced the trauma or struggle, you know, the culture and the society was much more focused on who was offended versus we have this, I think, perseveration towards who was doing the offending and what needs to be done to them. You know what I'm saying?
Good. Do you are you suggesting that all notions of justice are really just relative to place and time, and that there are really no sort of universal principles of justice that transcend time and place? So, right, in some places, you know, we use electrocution, and some we stone people to death, and other we just sort of turn the other cheek and forgive, and that they're all effectively equal, different, relative, and that there's no really universal norms for what justice is. It's all just kind of common practices.
Well, I think as your program has so far pointed out, we've pointed out that, you know, justice and the idea of it does span time and space quite significantly. And I think it begs the question in there is, well, what do we do about it? And what we do about it, I think we must try and have much more of a local and communal answer to that, because once you start getting such large notions of what is justice and what is retribution, and you start doing it for, say, our nation of, you know, 400 million people,
So you think it's better to leave, say, like, you know, in the United States, there are very different demographics with respect to what kinds of crimes deserve death.
Sure.
Certainly in, you know, a few states, you know, you can be executed for drug-related offenses. Other states, right, we have much higher standards. Some places have very deeply religious views of what justice is that's often particularly retributive. Do you think it's okay to sort of let local communities figure that out? And how local are you willing to go? The household?
Well, obviously, we deal out our own justice in our households every day, certainly. And, you know, what my neighbor does to their children for certain offenses, you know, I could agree and disagree with, depending upon what it is.
What if they beat the children? Because that's, you know, they think they're not learning the rules, they're not doing their homework, and we're going to lock you in the basement until
That's a good extreme. I'm glad you went that far, because if you go down to the individual level, then I think it can be equally confusing and diluted, and that's diluted, as the larger scale of getting confused about the issue. And I think it takes the right scale of community and population to really, I think, have the most measured amount of retribution or justice to any given offense. And what that magic number is, I'm certainly not one to say.
Me neither.
But I think that without those communal tenets instituted by, you know, the right number of groups of people, then I think it's very easily, you know, very easy to get lost.
You know, it's interesting, John. Some of our callers have said that the law helps us out, saves us from our more violent natures, where we want to lash back. I think Ken Burns called the justice system an appropriate collective response. What about, though, John, when the justice system follows a certain path? Let's say you're a victim. At some point, you don't really have a choice in what the end game is. So is that really justice, even though, yes, it was handled by this, you know, lovely sanitized justice system? What do you think, John? Go ahead.
I thought you were talking. My name's Aaron. I'm sorry, Laura.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had you up as John. I do apologize.
No worries. Well, you know, the law saving us, you know, again, is going to be a very, I don't know, maybe we look ourselves, I think we identify ourselves very much so as a nation and are a nation of laws. However, I think if you were to go take a poll of any given community across the entire nation, that's, you know, you're going to find very different responses on what laws are. I mean, all you have to do is say abortion, and all of a sudden, boom, there's one point. I mean, you can go down that rabbit hole quite large, and that's why I'm focusing so much on a community of scale.
Well, Aaron, it's great to hear from you. Thanks for being on the Socrates Exchange with us.
Yeah, no problem.
All right, bye-bye. And you can join our conversation. Get Socratic Exchange listeners at 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Select Wood of Portsmouth, providing contractors and homeowners with sales and advice on materials, including specialty lumber, featuring doors and windows by Marvin and Integrity, selectwood.com. And Great North Property Management Company, successfully managing millions of dollars for residential condo associations across New England for a quarter century. Details at greatnorth.net. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
Today on Word of Mouth, the sleepless army. Even the best trained soldiers can't function without rest. Or can they? Military researchers experiment with drugs to keep soldiers awake and alive longer than ever before, creating a new global arms race to conquer the war against exhaustion. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth stays alert for new ideas. Today at noon and again at 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Canoy. Today, it's the Socrates Exchange, where we examine one question through the Socratic method of asking more questions. And the question we're wrestling with this hour, how do we weigh justice with vengeance? Nick Smith is here, Associate Professor of Philosophy at UNH. And Nick, let's go right back to our listeners. The number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Now John in Burlington is up. Hi, John. You're on the Socrates Exchange on this question. How do we weigh justice with vengeance? What do you think?
Thanks for taking my call. Well, I just wanted to make a couple of comments. One, I think that we want to remember that our justice system is a deterrent as well, and so it serves several purposes, but you have to have a deterrent, and that's an important point. And I wanted to make a suggestion that I think some other countries do this, but when someone commits a heinous crime, like the bombings or harms a loved one and friends in any way, in that kind of crime rather than stealing a TV set or something, I think that part of the process should be to get the people that are hurt, whether it be the actual person that they harmed or relatives, the mother, for example, and allow them to be in a room with these people in a controlled environment, but let these people vent at this person and really let them feel the impact of what they've done. And I think some of them might get a thrill out of that, which is unfortunate, but I think many of them wouldn't. And I think if that kind of event would really bring home to the person that committed the crime what they've done. And I think that we sort of isolate all of the victims. You know, I mean, the actual person that was harmed isn't necessarily the only victim, of course.
Good. John, there is an example, and I recommend this story to everyone. It was in the New York Times magazine a few months ago, and it was a story about two teenage lovers who had been involved in a tempestuous relationship. They got in like one of these weekend-long teenage dramatic fights. The male got suicidal. There was a gun involved. The woman ended up kneeling before him, kind of pleading just in an emotional frenzy, and he shot her in the head and killed her. He had no previous record. He turned himself in immediately. The victim's parents were devout Christians, and they pretty quickly called for forgiving the man who killed at point blank range their daughter. And they had what's called the sentencing circle, and the victim, the offender, the victim was deceased. The victim was present in the form of a photograph of her and a few of her possessions, the families of everyone. And because of their Christian beliefs, they really very strongly wanted his punishment reduced as much as possible.
Wow.
And in this case, so all right, we asked the victim in the community what they want. And in this case, they really wanted deep reductions in punishment for explicitly religious reasons. Should the state consider those kinds of things? I mean, so you ask the victim, and what if the victim says, well, I deserved it? Or the victim's family says, well, we don't believe in punishment. We believe in forgiveness no matter what. And he's a good boy. It was just a teenage mistake.
Right. Well, my opinion would be, if that's what you're asking,
yeah,
is that I think it's wonderful that the parents thought that way. But I think that someone has to ascertain whether this person snapped and if they have what kind of ability they have to snap again. I looked at it more.
Do we need the family to be involved in that process? Because you were suggesting that it's important to get the community involved, but the community really doesn't know very much about the apparatus of administering justice and the available data, and they're emotional and they're kind of confused and
right.
They're religious.
My comment was not intended to help them be part of the decision making. I think that the decision making should not necessarily be there, but I think that it's helpful to let's say, the parents of a rape victim, for example, if a confrontation like I was discussing, where it's safe, it's a controlled environment, they are allowed to vent at this person. That's, I think, part of their healing. It also helps to inflict some pain to this person and really let them know what they've done. But I'm not suggesting they should be in charge of what kind of sentence the person gets. I think other people have to ascertain whether this person's a danger.
Good. So the victim shouldn't get any say in what the punishment is?
Well, I don't know if I'm going to comment on whether they should get any say, but I certainly don't think that it should be a 50-50 judgment where they get, 50%. Because they're not trained in this. I mean, there's professionals that try to figure this out. I mean, appropriate punishment is not always punishment. It's decision. You're making a decision on what you need to do for this person. Is this person salvageable? I mean, some people are not. You don't know if, depending on what their record is, they may have a terrible history of violent crime, and we may decide, you know what, they've got to be incarcerated forever, or it may be a one-time shot, like you were just explaining. I mean, there's a whole host of things. Someone has to consider all of that before you make a sentencing judgment of what's appropriate deal with them.
John, thank you so much for getting Socratic with us.
Thanks.
Great job.
The call.
The phone number again, 1-800-892-6477. It's the Socrates Exchange today on The Exchange. And Nick, let's talk to Haley in Conway. Hi, Haley. Thanks for waiting. You're on the Socrates Exchange on this question. How do we weigh justice with vengeance? What do you think?
Well, hi there, guys. This has been a really interesting conversation. And I just wanted to weigh in on one topic. We keep referring to the eye for an eye. And I just wanted to clarify that when that's read, that was actually written to keep people in check, to keep people in balance, so that, you know, if justice was sought or if vengeance was sought, it was appropriate and equal. It was an eye for an eye, not an eye, and I get both your legs. It was to keep this barbaric system that we have in us, you know, emotions rile up and someone yells at me, so I shoot them. Well, that's not eye for an eye. So it wasn't a permissive eye for an eye. It was a hang on a minute here. Let's have some boundaries. You know, let's do what's appropriate. It's an eye for an eye so that it's equal and it makes sense and it's fair if you have to go down that route.
Good, good. Now, you're pointing to an important distinction between revenge and retribution, right? We often think of retribution in this eye for an eye language of kind of, again, the scales of justice. Like, you take my eye, I take your eye. We're kind of even, whereas vengeance goes down this path of I want to get as much suffering from you as possible, and the more I get, the more I win, or something like that. But
yeah, and we have to be careful because I think that, you know, we can turn into this, you know, super, like when you watch children, one slaps one, and then it turns into this slapping match where, you know, someone has to get the last slap in, and it has to be harder so that they know that they're on top. We have this pride in us. And that's when an objective third party has to step in and say, hang on a minute, you know what, you're too close to the situation. Get out, both of you move away, and let me straighten this out.
Good, so you're worried about these cycles of revenge, right?
Yes,
so,
I mean, absolutely, because it never ends, you know? If you hit me and I hit you, well, now your brother comes over and he's bigger and he hits me, and then now my brother comes over, and, you know, pretty soon we've got the whole world slapping each other. And so we have to take a step back. We're too close. We cannot enact revenge. We can't. It's not healthy. It's not good for our hearts. It never ends. Our children have to deal with it.
Let me distinguish, though, between you're talking about a measured response and an eye for an eye being sort of the appropriate response. But an eye for an eye still deserves, right, like an eye. You're still inflicting the suffering that someone deserves, right? And essential to retribution is an idea that the offender, the villain, whatever you want to call her, deserves to suffer, right? They've done something wrong. They've taken something. They deserve to suffer. Now, it sounds like you're saying they deserve to suffer only so much.
I think they deserve to pay accordingly. I do.
Okay, so you're okay with wanting someone to suffer, but just the right amount, not too much, not too little.
I don't want them to suffer. And you keep doing that. You keep putting that on people, which is really interesting to me. It's very interesting, the psychological thing you're doing to people. But I don't want people to suffer, but I do want them to pay appropriately for
it. Right. And paying appropriately means they deserve some suffering. And, you know, if we're going to balance the scales of justice,
they've chosen to do that crime. They do have to take whatever our system, our country that we have voted in societally. They do have to take that consequence. And if it involves suffering to them, they should not have chosen to do the crime.
They have to get what they deserve.
They have to take it. You know, if I speed, I get a ticket. And I know that's coming to me. If I shoot someone, I know I'm going to have to face the court of law. So those are choices that they've made.
Haley, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate
it. Thanks, guys.
All right. Bye-bye. And let's see if we can get one more person in on this Socrates Exchange or two. 1-800-892-6477. Katrina is calling from Bow. Hi, Katrina. You're on the Socrates Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning. What a marvelous show. Thank you so much for prompting such an interesting discussion. I wanted to sort of raise, if you will, the spiritual theological perspective, because I think that we do sort of seek to wend our way through, on the one hand, the impulses towards mercy and forgiveness, but the demands of justice and that need we all have when a wrong is committed to see that, as the previous caller said, a price is paid and that there is a consequence. And I think that if you think of sort of basic Christian theology, what, you know, C.S. Lewis, the author C.S. Lewis, would have called mere Christianity, it does sort of manage to thread the needle, because the idea that you had, you know, a perfect being, a savior, if you will, who bears the demands of justice on behalf of everyone, past, present, and future, who has sinned, committed wrongs, committed crimes, then you have the demands of justice being met spiritually in that context. And then the call of mercy becomes the compelling one, because since, again, in this theological framework, everyone has fallen short, everyone has sinned, everyone has committed some sort of wrongs, and they too have partaken of this sort of comprehensive answering of the demands of justice, then the individual becomes to some degree obligated to forgive and be merciful, because they have themselves been the recipient of forgiveness and mercy. And I think that that, at least at a personal level, puts things in a different context. Now, that's not easily translated to how society responds to injustices, to wrongs, crimes, you know, transgressions committed against society as a whole. But for the individual, it's a very different path towards, you know, finding that balance between mercy and justice.
And Katrina, before I let Nick Smith jump in here, this is Katrina Sweat, right? And,
yes, it is.
And you've got a lot of thoughts on this, partly because you're the head of the Lantos Foundation, right, for human rights?
I am, for human rights and justice, yes. And myself, I'm the daughter of Holocaust survivors. So.
Right. That's the other thing I wanted to add in there. So lots of thoughts about justice, forgiveness, vengeance, for sure, when you're the daughter of Holocaust survivors. Wow.
Yep.
Go ahead, Nick.
I mean, this is a massive question, and I'm sorry for dropping it on you, but this is what we do here. I mean, do you think the Judeo-Christian God is a vengeful God? Would ever exact revenge?
Do I think the Judeo-Christian God would ever exact revenge?
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, if you look at scriptures, there both of those elements are there, this notion of the demands of justice and that they must be met, but also this notion of how are those demands met? Well, you know, even in the Old Testament, there are the traditions of the scapegoat. Now, again, that's something that in modern culture we think of of scapegoating as being a very unfair process, but my understanding of the practice in ancient Hebrew times was that it was a way of putting, as it were, the sins of the tribe or of the community or of the nation onto one that could bear them, and that in that way sort of expiating, if you will, those wrongs and those sins and permitting mercy to come in and forgiveness to come in. And so I think probably in the Judeo-Christian context, I would say that there is this notion that the demands of justice must be met. And I know I feel it in my own gut that if justice is just pushed aside in the interest of mercy, I personally find that to be a very unsatisfying resolution. It doesn't feel right.
And by justice there, do you mean retribution?
By justice, I think I'm referring to the same thing that lots of other people have referred to, the notion that if a wrong is committed, it must be paid for by someone and in some way. So I don't know that I would use the
by
word retribution.
By someone and in some way. So,
yes.
So
and so again, in a spiritual context or a theological context, the idea of mercy is that perhaps the perpetrator themselves are not the one who is of whom it is demanded that the price be paid.
So how about the marathon bombers?
Well,
should we take the punishment from maybe their parents? Should we punish their parents or?
No, I think in the context of the marathon bombers, and that's why I tried to make the point earlier that I think it's one thing to deal with it at a personal level, and another thing to translate it to society. Mm-hmm. I think society is less capable of adequately determining, you know, when and to what degree mercy is an appropriate response to wrongs. And so we properly institute a system of laws and a system of penalties that we consider to be commensurate, appropriate, and that don't cross that line that Ken Burns referred to of being cruel and unusual and feeding that sort of demon within each of us that takes a certain pleasure in you know, in a retributive way, punishing those who have wronged us.
Katrina, can I ask you a question on this, too? How about your parents? They were Holocaust survivors. I mean, mm-hmm. talk about justice, mercy, forgiveness, retribution.
Yeah.
I mean, how did they weigh all this?
Well, you know, it's such a great question, Laura. And in my childhood, what they chose to do, for which I've always been grateful, they chose to focus on the story of Raoul Wallenberg, who was sort of their rescuer. They called him the Moses of the North. He was this Swedish humanitarian and diplomat who came to Hungary in the final months of the Holocaust, and Hungary was in the grips of having the last remnant of its Jewish community obliterated in Budapest. Most of the Jews, almost all the Jews from the countryside had already been rounded up and deported, either killed in Hungary or deported. And this man came as really kind of a savior to the Jewish community of Budapest and is believed to have saved as many as 100,000 lives, innocent lives, including through different, you know, avenues, both of my parents. Anyway, they just chose to emphasize his story, to emphasize his righteousness, his virtue, his sacrificial willingness to kind of interpose himself between the innocent victims and this death machine that was bearing down on them. And I think in that way they wanted us to believe that even in the darkest of circumstances, the light of goodness can shine and that it can triumph. So that's sort of how within our family they dealt with it, which was a gift to us because it enabled my sister and I to take a terrible family legacy and find a lot of inspiration and goodness in it.
Well, Katrina, thank you so much for being on the Socrates Exchange today.
Thank
we appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you. It's a great show. Congratulations to you.
All right. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
And Nick Smith, boy, this has been fantastic. It's good to see you again.
Nice.
Thanks for coming on the air and getting Socratic with
Thanks
us. We really appreciate it. Nick Smith, Associate Professor of Philosophy at UNH. His forthcoming book is The Penitent and the Penitentiary. His other book is I Was Wrong, The Meanings of Apologies. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our interns are Faith Meixel and Catherine Muzzy. The Exchange is executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.